You're listening to Ryan Anderson's Model Railcast Show with your hosts, Craig Bisgeier and Tim Harrison. We're bringing you the latest news, reviews, and interviews on the hobby of model railroading. The Model Railcast Show, keeping you on the right track.
Ready whenever you are.
Yep, you just let it go.
Okay. All right, Model Railcasters, back from the dead. Show 210. Craig, my man, how are you?
I'm well. Not as dead as might have been thought.
Beautiful.
No, I'm good. I'm good, man. How are you?
Oh, good, good.
It's been a while.
It really has, but life has been crazy. And you know,
for me too, believe me.
Early summer just tends to be, all of a sudden, it's like you're no longer in winter, and all of a sudden everything just sort of hits the fan at once, and there's just a ton of stuff to catch up on.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah, so, and for you, you had quite the work experience, which we can get into. Actually, we might as well get into that now, because you got something pretty cool and train-related.
A little bit, yeah. As it turned out, a couple of weeks back, work took me out to a place called Bedford, Pennsylvania, which is pretty far close to – it's probably only about 2 hours from Pittsburgh. So it was a fair way out from where I live. Drove out there all Saturday and had to do a job there for a company that is a client of ours. And so while I was there, a couple of days we ended up kicking off a little bit early, and I managed to go, about 45 minutes from Bedford was Altoona, and I managed to go visit Horseshoe Curve, which was, you know, pretty cool. I really enjoyed that. Dave Ramos and I had been there 20 years ago, and that was a great, great trip. Made very funny by the fact that we were driving in a very small car, and when we left out, we had no idea how far it was. We looked at a map and it said, it's an inch. How far could it be? So, so 6 hours later, you know, I mean, but we did finally get there, and it rained like crazy the whole time we were there. We were there for about an hour and a half.
Oh, man. And you said –
6 hours out, 6 hours back, and about an hour and a half actually there in the rain. So.
Oh, that's so sad.
But we really did have a good time. And this time was a little bit better. It was still – it was a little bit rainy, but right. It wasn't nearly as bad. I only had to drive 45 minutes to get there, which was a nice touch. And actually, while I was there, I saw about 5 trains, which was fairly cool. A couple of stack trains, which was pretty neat. I saw a mixed freight, which actually had the CNJ Heritage unit from Norfolk Southern on the head end. That was actually pretty cool. And let's see, then I saw there was just before I left, there was an Amtrak train, and then there was one other, but of course now I can't remember what it was. But really, I actually had a really nice time. It was a lot of fun. Everything from work went well, and you know, so nothing to complain about. It was actually a lot of fun. Good trip.
That's really cool. How about on the Housatonic? Have you even had a chance to go down in your basement at all, actually, at all?
Well, it's funny. I'm actually speaking to you from the basement at this very moment.
There you go.
I actually have been down here a fair bit in the last couple of weeks. As what happens with an awful lot of people, I suppose, you know, things tend to get I'm one of those people who kind of forgets to put things away, and it ends up getting kind of crazy sometimes with the piles and piles of stuff. And so, being that I'm not the best cleaner, it tends to get, you know, fairly bad. And so my wife actually was very helpful in the last couple of days. She came down here with me one night. We spent a good hour taking things, deciding what could be thrown away and what needed to be saved, and putting things away. So we only got about maybe a fifth of the basement, but it was a real good start. I'm very happy with it. And so now I got to put a few things up on eBay. A fair bit of things that actually went out to the trash and things like that. So, and about the first aisle of the railroad is actually now fairly well cleaned up. So I'm hoping to ride that wave and kind of keep things going. The other thing that I did recently is that I don't remember. I think maybe last year, I think I might have mentioned right after Springfield, I had picked up a TCS Wow Sound Decoder.
Yeah.
Okay. And I had, it just sat around and I didn't do a thing with it for over a year. And then, you know, I got the, kind of got the hankering. I wanted to play with it. So I grabbed a locomotive on the railroad that didn't have a decoder in it. And, said, you know what? I'm going to try this. And it, what precipitated this was that, when we were recently at the RPM meet in Connecticut, the New England or Northeastern prototype meet, which we should talk about just a little bit.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And, so while we were there, I ran into Kaylee Zheng, who is a friend. And,
she is awesome. I have not had the chance to meet her, but everything I've heard.
She's such a fun person to be with. And she actually, did a clinic on using cell phone speakers as speakers in model locomotives instead of some of the speakers that we sometimes get when we're doing, you know, the, like the round speakers, things like these are real small. And it, she had taken a bunch of them and used them in a series of different locomotives. And let me tell you something, the sound on these things is just amazing. It's really, really good. And it turns out they're actually not very expensive either. For instance, like if you were to go to one of the websites that sells sound decoders and try to order, say, the average round speaker about maybe an inch or 0.9 inches, what happens is that that ends up costing you about $10.
Right.
Plus another, I don't know, $15 or $5 or $10 for a an enclosure to go with it to help make it sound better. Well, Kaylee showed a bunch of stuff, including some iPhone 4 and some iPhone 5 speakers, as well as a speaker from a Galaxy,
okay.
I think it was. And these are the aftermarket ones that you can pick up for people who are doing repairs on phones. And it turns out they can be had very inexpensively on eBay. And I actually found a spot where I ordered them directly from China, and I got 10 of them for $15.
Oh, wow.
It's insanely cheap.
That
you know?
Is cool. Okay.
It's cool. And these things are like about the size of a chiclet. You know, they're really, really small and they're ported. So, you know, they kind of are directional and you can set it up if you have the room in a locomotive, either in a diesel or in a steam engine. In a large steam engine, you could probably fit one of these right in the smoke box.
Okay.
Which would be really cool. On mine, I have to put them in the tenders because there's just no room in the locomotive, too small. But it actually fit fairly well. So I managed to take one of these and get it in there along with the TCS decoder and, put it on the test track and sure enough, it fired right up and I had it running for about 5 minutes and it was chuffing along great. And then all of a sudden, unfortunately, it stopped making noise.
Oh, pain.
That's good, you know, so I played around with a couple of things there. I thought, well, maybe I muted it by accident. And so I tried unmuting it, and it, nothing worked, unfortunately. So I ended up contacting the people from TCS. They were very, very nice about it. They said, well, sounds like you might have blown the amp, which isn't your fault, just it. It happens sometimes, you know, and so they said, send it back. So I sent it back this past Tuesday, and I'm hoping in the near end, put it back into the locomotive, and try it again. Cause for as long as it lasted, the sound was really good.
Right. You're like, that was really impressive, that 5 minutes I had.
Really was. And, so I'm very excited about getting it back and trying it again. And hopefully this time, you know, it'll last. Now, I did have somebody ask me on the website, was it a problem maybe the speaker overloaded the amp? I said, well, no, it's not because I tested it. I took a meter out and I actually tested it. It is 8 ohms, just like every other speaker that we normally use. So that couldn't have been it.
Okay.
So just one of those things that happens. But like I said, the people at TCS were really nice. They said, yeah, by all means, send it back. We'll take care of it for you. And so I'm just waiting to get it back now.
Yeah, and big shout outs to them for getting back to you so quickly and so awesomely too. I mean, that's really just kind of cool.
Oh yeah, absolutely. They were back to you within 24 hours, which is great. I mean, I think that that's, you know, that's pretty darn good.
Yeah.
So, and they were like, absolutely, you know, not a problem. Just send it to us. You know, they have apparently a 1 year goof-proof warranty, which I guess that some of the others, I don't know if all of the decoder manufacturers do, but you know, no questions asked. If there's a problem, just send it back and they'll fix it. So
that's cool. That's great.
It is cool. And it was just the first decoder installation I've done in a few years.
And you're like, so like to have it go in 5 minutes, I'm sure was a little frustrating.
It was a little frustrating, sure. See, the thing is though, the thing that I'm going crazy about now is if I find out that I really like it, then I'm going to have to upgrade a lot more locomotives and, you know,
right.
It's going to be expensive.
Yeah, I know.
The time factor in terms of getting them installed is not so bad, but getting them, you know, just buying them is going to be a small fortune. So I probably will have to do that a little bit at a time.
I tell you what, though, I mean, that will make a heck of a good show right there, too. After you've done a couple, you can really just kind of speak to it and just we could probably do a whole show on that.
That would probably could. I mean, I've actually now been – this is the third generation of sound decoders that I've had on this railroad. I started off with the very early Soundtracks ones, which are still in a lot of my locomotives. And then when I got the 440s about 5 or 6 years ago, I started putting in the Tsunamis, also from Soundtracks. And now with the WOW sound, it's just, you know, the sound quality is just incredible. And it's just amazing. I thought the Tsunamis were great when they came out, and they are, but these things are just night and day. It just sounds so realistic. It's crazy.
That is cool.
So, yeah, we could definitely talk about that when the time comes.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. Well, I've been busy, too.
You.
Not in the last week, per se, but before that, I had been working more on Pavonia Yard, and everybody's seen the pictures now of the reconfiguration of the ladder and stuff mm-hmm. like that.
Yep, that's looking good.
Thank you very much. It's been very rewarding. Some guy told me, and he was right on, that I need to get some ties under those turnouts. I'm not sure
really?
Who that guy was, but
told you that.
Very wise guy, I think.
No doubt.
And the other thing is that there's a particular area on the railroad. It's the residential section of Gloucester City that I basically picked that area to go ahead and do some scenery on or get it ready for some scenery because it's just track that runs through there. It's not like there's any switching in that part, so I don't have to wonder, okay, is this going to work operationally or not? It's just an area. It is what it is. Just the track goes straight through it. It's a bit, maybe about a 6-foot section in it. I decided, okay, that's the area that I want to concentrate on. So I took a drive out there. It's only about 10 minutes from my house and, took a few pictures and, which some of which I can actually use for backdrops because, the cars won't be in the cars would be a dead giveaway, obviously, because they're all 2015 or, you know, younger. But some of them I can use actually to work into the backdrop. But, by and large, they inspired me to paint the backdrop. So I started on some clouds, some happy big clouds. And that's been fun. But the one thing I realized in doing all this is like, oh, wow, even in just this section, I am going to need a crap ton of residential buildings. I just hadn't been paying attention to it, and I just happened to mention it on Facebook, and big-time props to one of our – he's actually been with a fan of the show for a while. His name is Robert Masterson. He's actually one of our pioneers back when Ryan used to do
way that. Back, yeah.
Yeah, and
– props.
He came to my rescue. He heard my plight, and his dad had left him – 10 of the kits. I don't know if you remember them. They were the houses of yesterday and today. They were the...
Oh, sure. Yeah, I have a few of those.
Yeah, they were so you have the row homes and you have them...
The San Francisco homes, the row homes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he's like, he contacted me. He's like, would this work? And if you see the houses in Gloucester City, you realize mm-hmm. it's darn close enough.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. There'll be some slight... Pretty much just in the way that I'm going to paint them, a lot of the houses in Gloucester City are white with the brick face.
Sure, sure.
But other than that, I was looking at the kit. You know, I looked at the kits, I looked at the houses, and they're not – are they exact? No, but it's so close – it's close enough that I'm a very happy guy, and it was just really, really cool. He basically came to my rescue, sent – so 10 kits, not bad at all. That's going to be a great start.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. That's, you know, that's really a nice thing to do.
It was very encouraging. Very –
yeah.
Restores
your faith in humanity.
Yes, know? Yes. So just a huge help. So I'm looking forward to starting work on building those.
That's
and
very cool.
I was just so pleased because they really, you know, I was looking through them and yeah, they're really going to capture the feeling of that, especially that particular area in Gloucester City. Mm-hmm. It's just going to work well. And, so I was really excited. So thank you, Robert. Thanks for sticking
Definitely.
With the show. It's great to see we've still got our older audience hanging in there.
It is. That is very cool.
And actually I started to, put up a little bit of fascia in some of the area too. I figured, you know what, let me just put some up
yeah.
and see how
it's amazing
that.
How that and backdrops just make your railroad look so much more finished when you put practically nothing.
Yeah, exactly. That's so true.
Yeah.
So other than that, it's it slowed down a little bit last week, although I've been really still trying to make some progress, even when I'm not down a layout room. So one of the things I'm working on is in Pavonia, I'm going to need, it wasn't there prototypically, but I need it, a curved crossover. So that's going to be fun to build. I've already started to, work out my template for that. And so started filing the rails and getting them spiked on. So that's going to be fun to try and build.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. It definitely was not as, it took me a couple tries to realize, okay, wow, yes, when you're doing a curved crossover, the radius of one switch varies so vastly different.
Oh,
than the radius
absolutely.
Of the other.
It does. Yes.
So it's been an education.
Yep.
But it's been nice to get some work done. It's nice because, we're lucky enough that the air conditioning system in the house puts a lot of cold air into the basement.
That was a good thing.
Yes, yes, because poor Dave, our mutual friend, poor Dave, his basement is not conducive to the summer at all.
Not so much, no.
So, and Craig, why don't you also then? Because you mentioned it earlier. You were talking about the Northeast NMRA, right?
Yes. Yes, that's right. We should talk about that a little bit. We just had it recently, back in the end of May, which is now almost a month ago.
I can't believe it.
it's with the whole, this whole beginning of the summer and the end of spring has just been crazy. So this is the first time we've had to talk about it. But went, had an absolutely great time, as always, and saw a whole bunch of really great friends. Saw some really good clinics on a few different subjects. I mentioned Kaylee Zhang's clinic already about the speakers, which was that was huge for me. I really enjoyed that, and I've been playing with some stuff, trying to get some things ready, and I've been kind of going back and forth with her on some ideas. Also, sat in on some clinics. There was one that a gentleman was doing on using, I think it was, trying to think which program it was. It's been a while, but there was a very good article, a very good clinic on doing signage for bottle railroad buildings and such like that. And he had a lot of really good ideas, particularly having to do with choice of font and some other things. Another gentleman, actually I think it was the same gentleman now that I think about it, whose name at the moment unfortunately doesn't come to me, but he also did a clinic on doing control panels in which he was using acrylic and having them laser etched in order to basically fill them with paint so that you could paint the lines for the track into the control panel and have it pre-drilled or pre-cut by the laser for the switches and things with words. And then once you had everything pre-colored, then you paint the whole thing black on the back and this nice shiny panel with the colored lines and the names and everything. It was really, really quite good. I really enjoyed that. It's something I would definitely think about for the future. And hopefully maybe we can get him on and talk about some of these things. That would be really cool. Like I said, unfortunately at the moment the name escapes me, but we will get back to that at some point and I'll let you know who that was. But I also saw Trevor Marshall there.
Oh, Trevor.
Who some people may remember. Yeah, have you met Trevor? I don't recall.
I only through the show.
Okay, good. All right. Trevor, as you know, used to have a model railway show. He no longer does it, but he's still very active. In fact, he actually now works for Railroad Model Craftsman, which I found out.
Yeah, I knew he had done some articles for them, but that's cool.
Yeah, he's actually working, I think, either as a freelancer or as an editor for them now. And he and I had a really great talk, at the show. One of the things that we talked about was some things he had done in order to help some S-scale passenger cars run better that he's having some trouble with them derailing because of basically some poor track that while he was working on that, he also thought, well, this got to be a better way to do this. And he actually developed with Tim Morris from Fast Tracks because they're both Canadians, they developed a way using some British techniques for actually equalizing frames. Normally it's done to do steam engines, but they actually equalized the passenger trucks for these cars so that they actually, within the truck, could actually, if the track was a little bit bent, the wheels and the truck could actually shift a little bit from up and down, side to side, in order to actually follow the track and not fall, if there was a dip on one rail, it wouldn't actually like get below where the flange was and the truck would walk off the track. Actually, the truck would actually change with the track, and keep tracking the way that it should, which was absolutely fascinating. He and I had a nice long talk about that, which was great. And he even mentioned that I said, you know, this would be something really cool to do, you know, even in HO scale, because he did it in S. HO is a little smaller, but, you know, it seemed to me looking at it that this is the kind of thing that it could be developed into something that could be used by people in HO. And certainly O scale as well. So I hope I put a little bee in his bonnet on that. Maybe we'll hear more about that at some point in the future. But so there was a lot going on. Of course, ran into Ramon Rhodes there, who was a guest on the show recently.
Sure, yeah.
And of course, we had a ball. That was a great fun. John Terry, and of course Dave Owens, who's one of the organizers. They always do a great job. And this year was no different. We all had a really, really good time. And I totally recommend going to that meet to anybody in the Northeast. We even had a few people, I think, come in from the Chicago area, and maybe a couple even from the West Coast. So that was actually kind of cool. And they had the most number of people at the meet this past year than they've had ever before.
But
so
Craig, I thought the hobby was dying. There can't be.
Yeah, that's what everybody keeps telling me. But every time I turn around, there's more guys. And sometimes girls, like I said.
Yeah,
you know, Kaylee was there.
Encouraging.
So, you know, and she's not the only one either. So, you know, it is. It's very encouraging.
That's cool. Wow, it sounds like you had a great time.
We really did. And, you know, going again to another one, there's going to be a Mideastern RPM meet in October. There's another one down in Virginia, which is Norm Wolf's show.
Oh, yes, the MARPM.
I think that's MARPM and the Mid-Atlantic RPM, which is another great meet. Recommend that very highly. I think we're having one in New Jersey this year, which I will get more information on, which would be really cool for people in the area to come out to. But there's a whole lot of things going on. There's a lot going on in the Midwest. There's RPM meets that happen out west in California. You know, if you can get plugged in with one of these things, do so. You'll have a great time, and you'll really enjoy it. I guarantee it.
And you know what? I think I remember hearing that there was going to be one in Jersey, and I can't remember for some reason. Maybe it was Violent was coming to mind. I can't remember.
Possibly. Like I said, I'm not
we'll
sure, but we will get more information, and we'll get back to you on that.
Oh, that's great. Well, with that, Craig, we'll go ahead and spin it to the rest of the show. 210. We had Mike Rose come on, and as many of our listeners know, we're kind of doing an opt-to-you-drop set of shows here, where we're going to be asking some people basically questions about, you know, it's easy to get, if we've never thrown an op session, it's easy to get that deer in the headlights look.
Oh, God, yes.
But there's enough of you guys out there that can talk us off the ledge and kind of show us how to do it. And, Craig, one of those shows, we're actually going to ask you those questions, too. So
I look forward to it.
I'll make sure you've got them.
No problem. I'll tell you the truth, whether I know it or not.
Exactly. See, that's the and that's what we want to hear. Broadcasters, it's show 210, and it's going to be our operations special, and I'm happy to have with me Mike Rose, and you should recognize him. You should be listening to the Scotty Mason Show with Mike Rose. Mike, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing wonderful. Just got the kids in bed, so I'm doing great. I mean,
oh, you know. Wow. 8:30. I'm impressed.
That's how we keep our sanity around here.
Yeah, the Rose boys were a little bit different. We tend to be night people, and I had all I could do to crowbar my kid in bed for 10 o'clock.
Well, we are night people, but basically the rule is just be in your rooms by 8:30 so that me and your mom can maintain some sanity. So.
Right. Have a little bit of us time.
Exactly. Exactly. Mike, one of the things I realized in talking to you off show was really the last time we talked, and I think even earlier than that, when you were on the show with Ryan, most of our listeners are not just familiar with Mike Rose on the Scotty Mason Show, but we're also familiar with you as to your modeling and stuff like that. And I think there's a misconception now. Whenever we think Mike Rose, we think a modeler, and I know you do that, but you've really been getting into operations. And as a matter of fact, as I've been following your progress – I wouldn't even call you a novice anymore. You're a regular seasoned vet.
Yeah, I would say if you take like the last maybe 2.5 years, I've gone from operating like, you know, once every couple of years and then tear things down and start over again to the point where I'm operating on my own layout maybe 6 or 7 times a year. And I'm also operating on my friend Mike Confalone's layout 7 or 8 times a year. So if you multiply that times the last 2.5 years, all of a sudden I've got a whole bunch of op sessions under my belt.
Yeah, that really starts adding up. That really does.
What I found is you really learn, I do anyway, a tremendous amount from each and every op session, whether it's one that you're putting on or one that you're attending.
Gotcha. I totally agree. I mean, it's. I haven't had the opportunity to put on one yet. I'm basically in the stage of getting I am going to have a double deck railroad eventually, but I'm not building that second deck until I know the first one runs right.
I think that's smart.
Thank you. So, yeah, I'm finishing up the couple of goals I have to finish up, and then I'll be able to start.
I would submit, though, that running right and operating the way you'd like are two different things.
See, you are seasoned at this, aren't you?
Well, and the reason for that is, until you start operating, it's all just purely theoretical.
Right.
And I think, you know, any good modeler is capable of building quality track work and having good electrical continuity and having trains that operate correctly on the track. And, of course, it's nothing like an op session, especially the first couple, to ring that out.
Oh, yeah.
But that's a little bit different from having an operational schema that not only works but is satisfying.
Yeah.
And that, I think, for us has been an evolutionary process, because if you apply that, I'm learning something from every op session theory, that means that the next time you're operating, you do things a little bit differently, right, capitalizing on lessons learned from the last one. And, of course, as you operate more and more, the lessons are less drastic, you know. But I have to say that after my very first op session, that was a real eye-opener. You know, you see how the flow of people in the basement goes, and that's an important factor, which I'm sure we'll get to.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the methods of how you tell people what you want them to do, that kind of evolves over time, too, and there's a lot of different ways to do that.
That's going to be some good stuff to get into. Mike, just out of curiosity, did operations, was that always sort of like in the background as an interest to you, or was it more of an interest than we realize? And I was just curious as to how you really started getting into operations.
Well, it was always a goal to have a layout that operates for me. Now, what that meant in the theoretical mind versus what it has evolved into, I would say they're quite different, because you don't know what you don't know until you know it.
Right.
And I think all of us have learned a lot from our obsessions, because, you know, you have this theory, you read about it, you might see some videos, maybe you've gone to some others as a guest, but unless you're a principal in one, regular in one that's not yours, or you're putting one on and the success of it and the way it operates is largely dependent upon decisions that you make, until you've done that a few times, you don't even know what questions to ask.
Right, right. It's true. I still remember my first one. I mean, I think I was pretty good at not having a deer in the headlights look, but I might as well have. It was fun, but it was like, whoa, okay.
Well, that my first obsession was utter chaos, and everybody had a good time. And when it was all over, they all went out to dinner, and I went upstairs and sat in a chair. You know? I was spent. Oh. And one of my initial goals and one of my learning so-called takeaways from that experience was, okay, it was fun, but it was really, really hard for me. And how do I make things easier for me as the layout owner and host, and yet still make sure everybody has a good time? So that was a primary goal. You don't want it to turn into this, for me anyway, I didn't want it to turn into like a paperwork drudgery situation.
Right, right. No, that makes a lot of sense. Well, Mike, if it's okay with you, I'm going to go ahead and start throwing some questions your way.
Sure.
Because, again, just for our listeners, we know who you are. But what is the name? I'll start, what's the name of the railroad you're modeling? And if you could just fill us in on things like the scale and time period, and also like the size of your model railroad, just to give us kind of a flavor of what's going on there.
Sure. Well, my layout started out originally as a freelance layout in Pennsylvania. And what happened is that over time, as I railfanned a lot in Pennsylvania, I stumbled upon a very scenic Conrail line that was the former Lehigh Valley Main Line from New York to Buffalo. And the portion of it that I stumbled upon, literally, I had a gazetteer and I was just kind of poking around and I saw this big, what looked like a railroad yard in the middle of nowhere, and I thought, you know, I should check this out and see what this is. Really didn't know anything about the history of this line. Admired the Lehigh Valley as a very photogenic, very cool fallen flag, but was certainly no expert on it. And at the time, my modeling interest was basically, you know, 90s, maybe the first 5 years of the 90s. So to make a long story short, I used the gazetteer to navigate to this so-called railroad yard. And bear in mind, I'm driving through some of the most scenic areas of Pennsylvania that I've ever seen. Curvy Susquehanna River, steeply treed hillsides and mountainsides, almost everywhere you looked. And I was really impressed with how it looked. And when I got down to where this railroad yard was, I realized that this was a huge industrial facility that was so busy, had so many cars associated with it, that it had its own railroad yard.
Oh, man. Okay. So, yeah.
So, you know, so I took a bunch of pictures, and that was that. That was in 2003. And then I made a return trip about a year later because I had started to see some other interesting things on the line in pictures as I started to look into it a little more closely. And in fact, that next time that I visited, I had acquired an all-wheel drive vehicle, and I literally followed every inch of the line from Pittston to Sayre. And a lot of people have heard of Sayre as being one of the major division points and terminals on the Lehigh Valley. In Conrail days, that whole Lehigh line was operated as the Lehigh line, but then was eventually downgraded to secondary status. And eventually it was spun off. And when part of it went to Reading and Northern, which would be the southern part of it that went from Pittston to Mahoopany, and Norfolk Southern operated the line from Mahoopany north to their yard in Gang Mills until they spun it off to what is now the Lehigh Railway, and they're operating that section of the line. So the center of the line is Mahoopany, where this giant Procter & Gamble plant is.
Okay.
And it's one of the biggest Procter & Gamble plants in the world. It ships all over the eastern part of the country. They make Charmin TP, Bounty paper towels.
We also know what that is.
Pampers. So I started to look into the line more and more and more. I started reading some articles from a guy named Mike Bednar, who has very interesting articles in TRP magazine and also has a number of books. And as it turns out, I've gotten to know him a little bit. I ended up writing him a letter, and he very kindly wrote back with a 4-page handwritten letter and a hand-drawn map, answering all of my questions and giving me his phone number. And I have since had several conversations with him. He's just a peach of a guy. And he's a guy that started out as an engineer on Lehigh Valley and Conrail, and then finally ended his career on Reading and Northern, and was intimately familiar with my entire line and all of the industries, and could tell me exactly what happened and when. And it was in large part these conversations, in addition to other research, that caused me to shift my modeling date back to 1985.
Nothing like a little inspiration, huh?
Absolutely. I chose 1985 because in 1986, Procter & Gamble stopped shipping by rail because Conrail kept applying surcharges to the shipments. But at one time, they were generating 100 carloads a day out of that location. Wow. And operated three shifts, and had a clerk on duty 24/7. So this was a major industry. It didn't really fit into the Conrail plans, but for Lehigh Valley, it was right on their main line. So when Procter & Gamble needed empties, they just tacked them on to whatever train was going by there and dropped them off, and they were able to service them better than I think Conrail was.
Okay, great. And what scale are you modeling this all in, Mike?
This is HO scale.
Okay, and that's great. And you, forgive me if you mentioned it, but what's roughly the size of the layout?
I didn't mention it, actually, but the size of my layout is my entire basement, so maybe 34 by 40, something like that. And I originally started out with the layout in half the basement, and then encroachment happened. And I just recently concluded a project to relocate my air conditioning air handler for the first floor and my water filters and got it all out of that back wall where it was and relocated it with great difficulty, I might add, into the central core of the basement where all the other utilities are. Gotcha. And but what it has done is it's opened up about a 20-foot long plus section of railroad for new development. So it's the final frontier, literally. And that's what's going to occupy my my activities over the next probably year and a half, I'd say.
Oh, that sounds really exciting, actually.
Well, it's you don't always get a chance to add a hunk of real estate to your layout that large when you feel like prior to realizing how to do that you pretty much reached the limit, you know.
Right.
So I am excited about it. It's really got the modeling juices flowing, and a lot of what was driving it to complete the circle here and tie it back in are lessons learned during the various op sessions that we've held.
Great. Fantastic. Yeah, that's my layout is the one that I'm currently building is basically because of what I picked up with after the first year of operating at different layouts, and I just realized the old layout just wasn't going to cut it. So,
right.
With your operating system, now obviously you're doing in more modern era, but that doesn't always constrain us to what sort of operating system we would. Are you using timetable and train order, track warrants, CTC, car cards, waybills, anything like that?
Well, all of those systems, I have some experience with. In fact, I had a very pleasant but bewildering experience at Bill Darnaby's house with the timetable system he has there. And basically, Scott and I were there actually, and we kind of bumbled through it. I think it's something that a little bit of learning curve is involved with. But we had a great time, and he's got a wonderful layout, and you know, it's very nice of him to invite us to that op session. But I think one of my takeaways from that experience was that is probably more era appropriate,
right,
for an era earlier than mine.
Right.
And I had some experience at Mike Confalone's layout with a waybill system. So a waybill system, in his case, is focused on the commodities that the cars are carrying rather than the car itself, if that makes sense.
Sure.
And it's a pretty laborious system because you literally have to create a waybill for every load, for every car that's going to move during your operating session. And, you know, for some cars that carry one commodity, that's not such a big deal. But a box car might have, you know, half dozen different waybills that he keeps on file and, you know, prints up, and takes him about 3 hours to stage an op session. And it's a good system. It's very prototypical because in his era, which at the time when he implemented it was in the 70s, and they were still a waybill-oriented kind of a setup, it's very appropriate for the kind of operations that we do up there. You do have to know what you're doing. It doesn't operate at all like a typical car card, which is, you know, do this, do that, flip it over, do this, do that, flip it over
right,
ad infinitum, which is fine. And I think a lot of people have fun doing that. And if it floats your boat, that's great. I think we wanted a little bit more prototypical reasons for doing some of this stuff. And with the waybill system, he's got routing instructions and what have you on there. So it's got the consignee, it's got the load, and I think he finds the you know, where it's coming from and where it's going to be very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So he's incorporated it into his op session. I think most of the guys that operate there care less about that than he does, let's say. But it doesn't interfere at all with our enjoyment of operating on his layout. And basically, we tend to focus on the routing instructions to figure out, you know, particularly if you're at a division point yard or something, you know, you need to figure out where you're sending these cars and what trains you need to put them on to get them where they're going. So that's an element of operations that he has that I don't employ here. On my layout, it's essentially a southeast to northwest compass direction, if you will.
Okay.
And it's a little easier to figure out where you're going. Pretty much everybody knows where Buffalo is and where Allentown is, and you're either going towards one or towards the other. And the way my staging is set up, you either depart from one end of it or from the other end of it. We don't run, obviously, round and round, although you could. It's a double-ended staging yard. So you depart from one end, you typically traverse the layout, and you arrive at the other end if you're a through train. There are some trains that are locals, and they depart from one end, do their work, and then return to that same end. So those are basically the two possibilities on a line that doesn't have a diverging route, doesn't have branches, doesn't have other subdivisions, and that's what my line is. So the way my layout is orchestrated, you have your major industry roughly in the middle of it. It's not exactly middle, but it's not near one end, let's say. And most of the main line trains will have a cut of cars that they need to drop off at this major industry, and they'll have cars that they need to pick up at this major industry.
Okay.
But the track work there is fairly complex, and the interaction between the crew that operates that industry and the train I find fascinating to watch. It's never the same way twice. And what they decide and to do and how they decide to do it is something they negotiate in real time, just like crews did on the prototype on my line. So I like that element of authenticity to it. It depends on how many cars they have and what type of cars they have and how plugged up Ubani is or how desperate for empties they are. So there's
right.
a lot of conditionals that you can sort of tweak here and there that make the operation of that never the same way twice, and therefore never dull and rote. Then the rest of the layout is more focused on various towns that have their own consignees, and there's two or three different locals that will go out and do their work appropriately at these towns and then return. A lot of this information in terms of who the industries are, what they got, were they still viable in my era, et cetera, et cetera. I have to credit Mike Bednar for that.
Gotcha.
He really was the mother load of high quality information, which has enabled us, I think, to do things in a very prototypical fashion. And I think that has contributed to a surprising degree in how much we enjoy doing it. And again, until you have that information and then begin to factor it into your operational plan, you just can't even conceive of how you would incorporate that into your op session.
Right. No, it makes sense. And really, too, one of the concerns that even I've had, and I know one of my friends has had, was that, you know, and again, if somebody enjoys what I'm about to say, that's fine, nothing wrong with it, but it really becomes not just about moving boxcars or hoppers around, it's about knowing what's in that and getting it to the right place.
Well, you want to have your crews, I think, have actual work to do, you know, with a purpose.
Right.
So to touch on how I get that across to my crews and give them what work to do, I have evolved a switch list system.
Mm-hmm.
And originally, the first time I did it, it was a tremendous amount of work. And I said, I've got to simplify this. And now what I've done is simplify the forms to a point where all I'm doing is handwriting in, reporting mark, reporting number, and I'm checking off a box, spot load, pull,
gotcha.
Pull empty, but whatever. All my conditionals, I just check it off. So I can stage my op session in under an hour. and it's never the same way twice. And it's really easy for people to understand, I think. Because all I want to be able to do is convey to them that, you know, when you get to Lacyville, you need to pull the empty covered hopper that's at the Agway there, and you've got two loads for them, one of which will go on their siding, the other one, put it where you find a spot, which is exactly the kind of problem the prototype crew would have had to solve. So that all I need to do is convey that. Right. And I base the creation of the switch lists and the instructions on my many conversations with Mike Bednar and other folks who have provided information about how a prototype railroad actually does it.
That's great. No, that's the way to go for me. And Mike, as for powering your layout, what are you using? What sort of system do you have there?
I have an NCE Power Pro.
Gotcha.
And I have two districts, so I have the booster. And we just added wireless to the system. Until recently, it was a plug-in throttle kind of a situation, and took a lot of heat for that, and eventually bit the bullet and put in the wireless. And I have been pleasantly surprised at the coverage, because I think I had told you that the central core of my basement has all of the, you know, it's got the furnace and the hot water heater and miles of copper pipe and the air conditioner and lots of ducts and you name it. It's all in that central core. And my NCE system is sort of on one end of the layout. You know, it's in one corner of the basement.
Right, right.
And so I really, you know, I wasn't expecting much, but my friend Ken McCory told me that I might be pleasantly surprised by the coverage. He's got a gigantic layout. If you're not familiar with it or you haven't seen it.
Oh, yes.
you can't even appreciate how big it is. It's easily 10 times the size of your average layout. And he does his whole place with one base station and one repeater. So I got a base station and I got a repeater. And the repeater's sitting in a box. I can cover the entire basement flawlessly without the repeater, which really surprised me.
Oh, that's great. Now, I know that when I've had a chance to operate at Dave Ramos's New York Harbor Railroad, mm-hmm. He has wireless, and he also has, you know, so he has the Wi-Fi router. And I've had really good luck even with the Y-throttle, just running the, you know, running it off of my iPod.
Interesting.
And so, yeah, that's been good, too.
Dave's room isn't gigantic, though, right?
It is not. No, he's got about a 20 by 20 area.
Okay.
So, yeah, so the coverage obviously it doesn't have too far to go there.
Right. So. And you also, I was talking with Jim Lincoln about this because I know Jim has operated on Dave's layout, and he was telling me that you tend to kind of remain in one spot when you're operating at Dave's, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's very unique that way. But, yeah, unless you're working a certain line called the high line, basically, yeah, you're finding a spot and you're staying there, and for some reason it's some of the most fun that you'll ever have.
Oh, I'll bet. Well, you know, the guys that work Mahoopany kind of have a similar situation because it's structured with, believe it or not, three different local yards. There are two double sidings that go into the building. There's another track on the outside of the building for raw materials in. There are chemical tracks that you have to spot things on. So those guys basically stay there all day if they want to. And it's kind of a similar situation, but the rest of the layout is designed so that when you leave the terminal, you go with your train. And there is one long tunnel that gets you from one side of the basement to the other, and it sort of replicates a tunnel on the prototype. But aside from that, in my big redesign a couple of years ago, I changed the entire routing of the main line to eliminate 90% of the hidden trackage and simplify what had been kind of a spaghetti bowl.
Gotcha. Yeah, I have to tell you, I have fallen in love with that approach myself. I've seen so many things go wrong on hidden track.
Right.
And I just love the idea of not doubling back on an area that my train has already run through. So.
Well, yeah, exactly. And you know, you can be prepared to live with that, but then when you start operating it, that gets tiresome very quickly.
Yeah, definitely. And you sort of talked about this a little bit, But just in case you had something more to add on it, what really was it that got you into operations, Mike?
Well, I always wanted to operate. I mean, I think that what got me into modeling was watching the prototype. And even as a little kid, you know, five-year-old kid, I'm down in the New Bedford Yards with my dad watching the New Haven Freight leave and then Penn Central. So to me, trains move, and I want my models to move as well. And, you know, that's nothing against a diorama modeler or someone that's just into building locomotives or cars. But for me, I want the whole system to be in harmony in terms of its level of detail and the way it operates. It's got to feel right. It needs to look right. It needs to sound right. And of course, everybody has their own personal definition of what that is.
Right.
My current goal is to get the whole layout what I would call presentable, mm-hmm. which means, you know, everything ballasted, no exposed foam, no exposed plywood, trees where they're supposed to be, buildings where they're supposed to be. And beyond that, you know, water where it's supposed to be. But beyond that, you know, there's oodles of super detailing that you can enjoy and just do as long as you're able to do it, you know, and that's kind of where I plan on being within about a year or so.
Nice. That's great. Well, one thing in discussing then, Mike, going a little deeper here, and some of these questions might even be a little loaded, but who knows? But we want to discuss what makes a successful op session. And for you, where does that start?
Well, okay. So one of the main goals for me as somebody who hosts an op session is to make sure everybody has a good time. That might seem obvious, but that doesn't happen accidentally. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I want everybody that comes to have a good time, and I want me to have a good time.
Right.
maybe that sounds selfish, but, you know, that's kind of what this whole thing is about, right?
I would totally agree with that.
it's supposed to be fun.
Right.
And when it's not, I mean, I've seen people agonize over stuff, and I just want to tell them, relax, you know, it's a hobby. But, you know, that's just me. It's I think anybody that knows me can tell that I take it seriously and I can be pretty focused and intense about it, but never at the expense of enjoying myself. I think of myself as a process guy, and I want to enjoy the process of doing all of this stuff. So working backwards from the primary goal of we want to have a good time doing this, everything is kind of driven by that. So most of the guys that in our little ops crew are very, very like-minded. We have similar goals. We're all good modelers. We often work on each other's layouts because everybody's got their own area of specialization, you know. So people tend to fall back on me for some of the heavier engineering stuff that tends to be tricky to solve. And you know, when I'm planning out a new area, I'll get, you know, Mike Confalone down and you know, we'll brainstorm the whole thing because he's got terrific spatial sense, and he's no slouch in photoshopping either. So I know who to you know, work with to get my
Absolutely.
Photo backdrops the way they need to be. And you know, I do all of his sound installs, and you know, it's very symbiotic. You know, there were times in the past where I was failing miserably doing static grass, and several of the guys who were very accomplished at it just came down, and we had a static grass party, and all of a sudden it went from, you know, not so presentable to wow, what a difference grass makes. You know what I mean? So,
right.
so this like-mindedness of the group, I mean, we're all friends. You know, we've gone rail fanning, we've traveled and gone to prototype meets, and you know, we're all friends. So, you know, when you're spending the whole day with a group of guys, you got to like them all, and they got to be the right mix. And there might be people that you love dearly that for whatever reason don't mesh with that group, so you wouldn't maybe include them in that particular group of people. Maybe you do a different obsession with them and other people. Not everybody meshes together, you know. It's no knock on anybody. It's just a fact.
Right.
So having the right group of people, I think, is very important to have fun. The other thing we found pretty quickly is you don't want too many people there. You don't want extra bodies hanging around doing nothing.
Right. No.
It just clogs up the works. And and you know what is at a premium in most layouts is aisle space, and you don't think about it when it's just you or you and a friend working on your layout.
Right.
But you know, when you've got 7 or 8 guys running around in your basement, and you've really only got room for 6 guys to run around, that 7th and 8th guy, you know, it just clogs up the works. So not only do you want to have the right number of people to fit your basement in general, you also want to be a little bit careful when you're sending out your jobs that you're not crowding everybody to work in one spot at the same time, you know, like back to back. So we try to avoid that whenever possible. We try not to have 2 different crews competing for aisle space back to back in the same spot. So having enough room, keeping people busy so they're not just hanging around bored, having a good lunch.
Yes. Oh, boy, that's a good one.
You know, lots of stuff to drink, lots of pencils. In other words, anything that would make it annoying, you just eliminate that. And it's real easy to have lots of pencils. You buy a box of them, you sharpen them, they're everywhere. That problem goes away. You know, it sounds simple, but it's as you do these things, you just, as the layout owner, take note of all these little things and you just chip away at them, and the obsessions just tend to get better and better.
And really, Mike, that really dovetails with my next question. What is, you know, during the session, what sort of things can make the session go smoother? Now, sometimes there's things that you can actually do, I'm sure, while you're, you know, in the middle of the session itself. But generally speaking, you know, what are some of the things that an owner could do to make it go smoother?
Well, I think if you talk to most owners that host op sessions, they tend to run either very few or no trains during the op session. You know, you think about the jobs on a real railroad. You've got a conductor, you've got an engineer, you've got a dispatcher, you've got a train master, right? All of these functions need to happen during an op session. So as the layout owner, I tend to be like a combination train master and road foreman of engines, if you will.
Gotcha.
It means that I you know, sometimes I act as a hostler in the staging yard. Sometimes I'll do a little live staging. I answer questions about something, anything that might be ambiguous in my instructions. I expedite, you know what I mean? I solve problems. I deal with whatever comes up, whatever it is. Sometimes I have to whip out a soldering iron and replace a repair set of points that chose that inopportune moment to break, you know what I mean? And, you know, if it's a switch that's not that important, you blue flag it and you say, hey, you know, it gets repaired for the next session. But sometimes it's a critical thing and you got to get on it and fix it. So mercifully, that doesn't happen very often. And if you're prepared to do it quickly, and you know what you're doing, usually you can fix something, you know, pretty quickly. So I would say, though, that one of the things that has made one of the biggest differences is I have an old friend of mine that I've known since I was in elementary school, and he's a professional dispatcher. Okay. And he and I have been working on my railroad for, like, forever, right? So he has been dispatching most of Mike Confalone's obsessions and so far all of mine. And the minute we added him to the mix, it changed everything.
Wow.
I can't overstate the impact that having somebody that knows what they're doing to dispatch makes on operations. It made it be from dispatching by committee to it just flows and it works because he's just got that kind of mind. He knows the train links and he knows the siding links and he's planning his meets, you know, and, you know, he's playing chess and we're playing checkers. I mean, that's like, you hear that cliche, but that's really, there's a reason guys like that are doing what they do.
Yeah.
He's like an air traffic controller in 2D on the ground. And it might seem that, you know, how hard is it to dispatch a model railroad? Well, you know what? You kind of have the same issues that the prototype does, but you've got less space to deal with it. So it's in some ways even more difficult.
Right.
And if it's done well, it's huge. And if it's done poorly, everything just kind of grinds to a halt and nobody really has fun. So having somebody that just does the dispatching and is good at it and enjoys it and wants to do it, that's huge. Having someone that is the train master and troubleshooter and expediter, that's a key role. And that means that the people who are there to operate, that's what they get to do.
Right.
They get to run trains and switch cars, and that's generally why they come. And when all of that other background stuff is handled, nothing else gets in the way of that. And then for me as the layout owner, what I get out of it is it's really the only time that you get to see this big system that you've designed and envisioned. It's the only time you get to see it come to life.
Right.
You can run some trains around the layout and work with a friend, but when you got five or six people and it's all orchestrated properly and you just see it functioning as theorized and as designed, I find that immensely enjoyable. And I do a lot of just rail fanning on my layout, you know, watching my cars and engines being operated properly, going across my layout and interacting with other crews. It's great in a way that until I started operating, I never could have really fully appreciated, I think.
It sounds very rewarding. It really is. Oh, that's great. Yeah, I had the chance, you talked about dispatcher, I had a chance to stand over Jim Schweitzer's shoulder once, and I think he's dispatched for Tony Custer.
Okay.
And he's done some work for Craig Biscars, who's Satonic. And yeah, just to watch him go and looking at all that the dispatcher is doing and realizing how quickly that could become chaotic real fast, and watching a real artist just take it and transform it into something amazing was really rewarding to see that. So.
Well, I told my friend Dave, I said, you know, it's inconceivable for me to think of having an obsession without you. You're screwed now. You know, you got to do it. You know?
Permanent crew.
I know that if he couldn't make it for some reason and I had to do it, I could bumble through it.
Right.
But I know for certain it wouldn't be as good. You know, it's that important.
Yeah. No, that sounds great. By the time you get to the end of a session, what should be expected and or anticipated even?
Well, you know, you start your obsession with an agenda. You have a lineup of trains. And usually I plan that lineup with my dispatcher friend so that the order of business is sort of generally understood. Mm-hmm. And there's a method to his madness in terms of the order he wants to see stuff done in. That's true in the prototype too.
Right.
And then when I am building the trains and doing my paperwork prior to the op session, I'm operating from the lineup that we've arrived at. Optimally, you are designing an op session in such a way that you run the majority of the trains. And if you get to the end of the op session and you've only run half the trains that you thought, your plan was probably overly optimistic.
Gotcha.
Right? Or you ran into issues that prevented you from doing what you should have been able to do, and you try to figure out and understand what that is. Never had that problem. Usually you end up with, at most, a train or two that didn't run. And once in a while, you end up with a little extra time, and you wish you had an extra train to run. But that's kind of like a good problem.
Right.
To give you a sense of what happens in an op session, Mike C's layout is probably maybe 30 or 40% larger than mine. I mean, it's a good-sized basement plus a two-car garage. So he's got a much larger layout in terms of the amount of main line. It's possible that I have more siding and industrial capacity than he does, although he's been adding some stuff, so I don't know that I can say for sure if that's still the case. But the yardstick is that during an op session, both of us move in the high 200s of freight cars in the session. And it's you know, it's a total number of cars that are probably within, you know, 15 of each other's layouts, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And it seems like that roughly just under 300 car total is about right for an obsession that trains are rolling at. Usually people are arriving like between 10 and 10:30, and we've got wheels in motion, you know, quarter of 11 or 11 the latest. And we usually run till about 1 o'clock and break for lunch, and then run all afternoon until, you know, 5:30 or 6, depending upon when people get hungry. So, and his, you know, and the other thing, reason for that is, you know, some of the people come from far away. Most of us are within 2 hours of each other, but we've got one friend that comes from Syracuse, New York. He's got a much longer drive, and he's getting up at like, you know, 5 a.m. to come to our op sessions, which is very flattering.
Yes, definitely.
When his layout is up and running, I said to him, I don't know if I can promise you the same thing, you know. But so given that amount of time and the, you know, 6 crews, let's say, total, that seems to be about the right number of cars when you have trains that are not, you know, grossly long. So a typical train we run in an op session is, let's say, between 25 and 30 cars.
Okay.
When I run a train myself, I want a 40 or 50 car train, you know, but that's on basement sized layouts, that can be death during an op session. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, and on a typical road train out of the 25 or 30 cars, maybe a half of the cars on the train, roughly speaking, are run through and the other half are being exchanged or dropped off at some point. Once in a while, we'll run a unit train or something just across the entire layout just to mess everything up. But,
nice.
But that's you know, so and what we found was in the beginning things would get clogged up a little bit, but if we took off some cars, you know, just taking off 20 cars or 25 cars, you know, it brings you below that tipping point, you know what I mean?
Right.
So if you have too many cars on the layout, it's too easy to get to a gridlock situation. Having the right number of cars is something you sort of arrive at by a little bit of trial and error. And if you have the discipline to stick with it, things just tend to flow along nicely.
No, that makes sense. All right. So to someone who is just about to throw their first op session, if we haven't covered it, and I think we've mentioned little bits of stuff here and there, but for someone just about to throw their first op session, what do they need to know?
Well, for anybody to throw an op session, having never been to one, I think job one is go to some op sessions before you hold one.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have some clue as to what you liked and what you didn't like about anything that you attend. And if you're trying to do an op session without ever going to one, it's just too theoretical. The odds of it going well are dramatically reduced if you've never been to an op session. But I would say, have plenty of stuff to drink for the guys. Have or gals, you know. Don't have too many people. Don't serve greasy snacks.
Yes.
You don't want fingerprints on things that you carefully weathered. You know. Above all, don't have expectations that are so high that they couldn't possibly be fulfilled.
Right.
You know, endeavor to have fun and make sure that your attitude is to treat it as a learning experience, and take notes, write stuff down.
Right.
Because you might think you're going to remember all that stuff, but you're not. Unless you've got one of those photographic memories.
Oh, I do not have that.
If you write it down, you know, you can kind of use it as a checklist later, you know what I mean? Doesn't mean you have to be formal and, you know, open up a copy of Microsoft Project and put everything into it. That's a bit much. But, you know, a little bit of organization and attention to detail goes a long way, I think.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I know a piece of advice that was given to me, and I think it kind of goes with what you were saying, especially with, you know, making sure you're kind of chilled out about it, is that, you know, on a real railroad, you know, how many runs do guys have to make before they even qualify, before they can even handle a train?
Well, that's an excellent point.
You know?
And the other thing that you should keep in mind is things will go wrong.
Right.
there are things that will not be according to plan. You'll have trains that you tested out that ran perfectly, derail for some reason in a way that's not reproducible.
Right.
And don't forget, the way people operate trains, no two operators are the same. They're not going to do things the way you envisioned. So you can test until you're blue in the face, but the best way to test the layout is to put a bunch of people on it and say, go for it,
right.
You know? And, so, you know, expect the unexpected. Don't get down on yourself if there's things that come out of it they have to fix, because you're not alone. I think it happens to everybody.
Right. Well, that makes sense.
And the more you operate, and the more of that stuff you sort of wring out of the system, the better it flows. But it will never, ever be perfect.
Right.
It's not perfect on the prototype either.
It's true, right? No, that's a great point to remember too.
Well, and once in a while, my dispatcher friend will throw a monkey wrench into the works if things are going too well.
nice.
He'll tell the crew that they've got a hot box on an N&W boxcar that they have to set out. You know what I mean? So. He's trying to build in realistic events so that you're not just, you know, mindlessly doing this stuff.
Right. Well, that makes sense. That does. And, you know, you've already alluded to this. So, one of my questions was food or no food, because I know different owners can have different takes on it. I know some people are nervous about food getting near their trains, but it sounds like you're all about having a good supply of food near, at least nearby.
Well, I think the way we do it is this. What we found, we've tried having snacks downstairs, and that's less good. It's okay to have, you know, bottles of water or whatever, but, you know, we break for lunch and we go upstairs and, you know, get you out of the train room for a bit, and, you know, you're eating in the kitchen or in the dining room,
right.
Or usually in both, and then you go back downstairs, you know, and I think it's probably a good idea to keep the food separate from the layout room, because chances are, unless you've designed an elaborate crew lounge, you probably don't have adequate space to do it right.
No, that makes sense. Well, Mike, how about some reflection then on some of your personal experiences and what you've observed in other op sessions that made for a better experience for you? And then maybe you could even go into how you might have been able to work those things into your own op session.
Well, maybe this isn't strictly op session specific, but I remember, you know, I've been doing this a long time, and people say to me, gee, how long did it take you to build your layout? And I never know how to answer that question, because I have taken down and rebuilt so much of my layout that I'm pretty sure that there's nothing original on the entire layout at this point.
Right.
So if I were to tell you how long it took to build it to the current look, it's a surprisingly short amount of time for a layout that's been under construction for a couple of decades. Now, the reason I brought that up is that when I built the layout, it was the first large layout that I'd ever built, and at the time I built it, I was trying to build it to, you know, military spec standards. I had spline roadbed, and I had, you know, 5-cab rotary DC control, and,
right.
You know, I used heavy wire and all of that, which is good because I was able to reuse the bus when I went DCC. But the layout was built originally pre-DCC.
Okay.
So when DCC came out, my thought was, well, there's no way I could put decoders in all of my engines. I've got 100 engines. So what I'll do is I'll put my DCC setup on one of the cabs. I'll try to run a mixture of DC and DCC. Anybody that's tried to do that knows that's a disaster.
Right.
And it wasn't too long before I ended up removing all the rotaries and putting in a proper bus and, you know, in other words, building a proper DCC layout. Because when I took my first two DCC engines and started operating them, I knew in 5 minutes that I would never run another DC engine again for the rest of my life.
Right.
It was that much of a game changer. So I was all set. I committed to it. I put DCC decoders in all of my 100-and-something engines. And I had my first op session, which was the really chaotic learning experience one. And some of the guys brought over some sound-equipped engines. And I thought, oh, no.
Yes, I hear you.
And that was a learning experience because, you know, sound can be controversial. I know some people who are great modelers who are very passionate against sound. I know some people, Tony Custer is an example, no sound, no layout is how he feels about it. So it's the opposite extreme there. I think, you know, my contention is that a lot of people who are anti-sound have never really heard really good locomotive sound. And at that op session that I was mentioning, when some guys brought some sound-equipped locos, you know, there was some factory-equipped sound locos. And they sounded so bad that I could see why somebody could be anti-sound. I mean, they really sounded offensively bad to my ears.
Right.
And it wasn't until I went up to Mike Confalone's and I saw and heard sound done better than factory that I realized the possibilities of what you could do with sound. And of course, you know, fast forward and now I'm, you know, as I have a part-time business installing sound in locomotives, and I've done literally hundreds of them, including, you know, 100 and something of mine over again. So I guess where I was going with that is something like sound, you know, makes such a big impact on how you interact with the layout and the realistic operation of trains. And, you know, some people say, well, you know, I'm hearing it in my head, but I'm telling you, when you see a quintet of low sound equipped engines with terrific recordings and great speakers charging up the hillside at Confalone's layout or coming around the bend at Mahoopany on my layout, you know, there's nothing like it.
You're right.
And I think that if there are any doubting Thomases on sound, just keep an open mind about it until you have the chance to experience it done right. I think it's a game changer.
I think that's, I would agree. I had similar reservations and like you, I think my first exposure was one that basically sounded like the smallest possible, it sounded like one of my grandfather's old hearing aid speakers, you know, it had about that quality to it, so.
Yeah, the first one I heard sounded kind of like my electric razor, and I thought, how could somebody with ears put that out there and say, yes, this is good?
Oh, man. Well, you know, you've mentioned about you've talked about your layout evolving and stuff like that, and really that kind of flows into one of my other questions here, and that is, what have you done to fine-tune your op sessions from lessons that could be learned only on your own layout? You know, because obviously there's some lessons that you're only going to be able to learn in your own layout. You have a distinctive track plan, most likely, or at least a distinct variation of that.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, I think you learn quickly. The layout and the obsession show you what works and what doesn't. And then, you know, you can choose to react to that or not. It's always a big mistake, I think, to not be looking for continuous improvement in the obsession and taking some of these lessons learned. A perfect example is the number of cars. Every time we have reduced the number of cars down to the proper level, it's made a dramatic difference in how the whole system functions. You got to think of it as a system. You've got to have adequate staging capacity, and if you don't, then you need to run fewer trains. In other words, the amount of trains you run needs to be reflected in the amount of staging capacity you have to bring these things on and off the layout, if that's what you're doing. You could have a very, very modest type of layout, a switching layout. And maybe staging isn't even an issue for a layout like that. So I guess what I'm saying is you have to sort of really think about and be looking at what the issues are for your layout that are unique to your layout and make sure that your planning for the next one incorporates the fixes for what you're seeing. You know, if there's too many guys in a particular aisle, you make sure that next time you dispatch it differently so that you don't have that clog of humans there, which kind of interferes with your enjoyment of it. So, you know, if it sounds like I keep saying less is more in many cases, that I think is the key. There's an optimal amount of people, an optimal amount of cars, an optimal number of trains that you run. And if you exceed any, there's optimal train length, you know what I mean? If you exceed any of those, it's, the session is going to let you know that you did, and next time you scale it back, you know, to fit that. And, you know, it's not like in one op session you'll identify all those things and then fix them all for the next op session and then everything will be perfect. Continuously evolving thing. You're not going to want to do the exact same thing in every op session either, I don't think. So this process of guessing, observing, learning, compensating, and trying it again, that to me is what makes it interesting, because it's like this organic living thing, you know what I mean? It's, it's all these moving parts, and add humans and the element of uncertainty, and stand back and watch the show.
Excellent. And it, just out of curiosity, off script for me, is that what led to dismantling? Well, I say dismantling, but I know you used to have what has been affectionately termed as Grainzilla, but that is no longer there, correct?
Well, you know, it's interesting you should mention Grainzilla, because I guess it's one of my more well-known industries. I did an article in RMC on it way back, and there was an article on the relocation of it to a much more appropriate spot in Model Railroad Hobbyist probably a couple of years ago. And the thing about Grainzilla was it was originally designed to screen out the transition between scenic area and staging on my layout.
Okay.
So that was what it was conceived to do. And I kind of modeled it loosely after grain elevators that I'd seen in the Port of Albany. The way the silos are configured, the way the elevator building is, the ladder cages, that's all straight out of what you see in the Cargill facility at Port of Albany. Although they're very similar in many of these other places you see in Cleveland and Toledo and Buffalo and all over the place. So the problem with Grainzilla was, because it became such a focal point, it actually drew attention to the area that I was trying to not draw attention to.
Okay.
So it succeeded as a model and as an industry, but not as a distraction. It had like the opposite effect, which I hadn't anticipated. So I tried hiding some of the things and going through all this elaborate stuff to disguise the air conditioning ducts and what have you. It didn't really work, and I ended up relocating it. So when I relocated it to an area that used to be a staging yard, it looked better there. It worked better there. Everything was cool, except that as I got more and more prototype focused, you know, you've got this glaring issue that it didn't really exist on my prototype.
Yes.
So there's that problem.
Right.
And the other thing we found was that although it was a cool place for me to look at my covered hoppers, it wasn't tremendously interesting to switch out. You'd bring a 16 car train to it, you'd cut it in half, you'd put 8 cars in each track, and you'd leave. It wasn't much different from a 2 car industry in that respect.
Right.
So it was occupying a lot of real estate, right, for the amount of operational interest that it engendered.
Right.
So, I blame Confalone for this idea originally, but you got to be careful with him, because a lot of his ideas are very infectious, but they're often right. I can't tell you how many things he's floated that I immediately dismiss as non-starters, but then the more I think about them, I end up doing it. So it's annoying, but it's useful. So it was his idea to basically sell it off and model something that existed on the prototype there. And I kind of went full circle on it, and it actually found a good home with Matt Herman of Loke Sounds.
Oh, well, so, that's good.
I feel good about that, and yes. Matt said he would give me visitation rights on it once in a while. So I actually handed it off to Matt when we were all in Collinsville at the New England Proto Meet there a couple of weeks ago. So the absence of Grainzilla in its footprint there will enable me to model the big paper mill, which in my era was called Suwanee Paper, in Ransom, Pennsylvania. And it's the first town north of Pittston.
Okay, yep.
But that is about half the area that I opened up. The other half of the area I opened up is going to be the town of Tunkhannock. Most people know that name associated with the viaduct, which is really in Nicholson, on a different railroad. But Lehigh Valley went through Tunkhannock too. And even in Conrail days, had several consignees there and a small yard there and some interaction with the P&G plant, which was just up the line in Mehoopany. So I always wanted to model that town, but I never had the space to do it. But when I relocated all of that equipment, I had the space to do it. And I also had the incredible good fortune to run into a guy who's now a friend of mine by the name of Wayne Sittner. And Wayne is the only guy I know of that has pictures in my era on my line and has supplied me with some just astounding photographs without which I couldn't have done many of these interesting things that I'm modeling. So he gave me some amazing pictures at the meet of a coal dealer that was there and a grain elevator that I didn't know existed and another grain elevator that I wanted to model and loading docks and team tracks and handcar sheds.
Oh, wow.
I could go on and on, but I could model this entire town based in large part on pictures in Mike Bednar's books and Wayne Sittner's photos that he gave to me. So, that was just one of those happy accidents that will result in what I think will be a very interesting section of the layout to operate. Now, my friend, the dispatcher, immediately said he was worried about the car count. You know, he said, you know, that paper mill is gonna need a lot of cars and you start adding that many cars to the layout. And I said, Dave, no worries, because the total car count on the layout isn't going to go up with these things added to it.
Nice.
At least not cars that move
right.
in an op session.
Right.
And that's the key. Not every industry has to be switched in every session.
Well,
Prototype doesn't do that either.
Right.
You know what I mean? So we're going to keep the total moving car count the same, but we'll have more flexibility and more options. So I think that'll make it that much more interesting.
That's great.
So that's the story of why Grainzilla that I slaved over is no longer here.
Oh, man.
It was, you know, it's like losing a child, you know what I mean?
Like but yeah, no, no, but it's funny though because I get it because you put a lot of time into it, you put a lot of nurturing into it.
Yep.
But I'm glad to hear that child has found a new home, Mike.
Well, I look at it this way. You know, at some point they have to leave the nest and fly.
There you go. Oh, that's great. Well, Mike, in conclusion then, what I want to do here is to end by giving you a soapbox. And just really, this is your chance to answer the question that I should have asked but didn't. And just something that you'd really like to say about op sessions that you feel people should know. And if there's such a thing, what would that be, Mike?
Well, I think a lot of people that have layouts, and maybe I'm all wet on this, but I'm just basing this on anecdotal evidence. What else have we got to base it on?
It's right? True.
there's no Quinnipiac poll on this stuff.
Right.
But I think a lot of people that have layouts never have an op session. And a lot of people that have layouts never do much with their scenery. You know, they get to a certain point and they don't go further with it. And you know, if they truly don't want to, that's one thing. But I think a lot of the hesitation in moving forward is fear based. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, I think people look at scenery and they think, oh, that's hard, but it's not. And they think, oh, hosting an op session, I have no idea how to do that. No, you don't. There's only one way you will.
Right.
Is to do it. And I would encourage people who might be more lone wolves to reach out a little bit. You never know who's going to end up being your best friend that you haven't met yet.
Right.
And I have developed more really good, very close friendships in this hobby than I ever would have anticipated just by going to some proto meets and being open to interacting with some folks. And that's not naturally me, and I'm, believe it or not, a little bit on the shy side, but the kinds of friends you'll make and the kinds of people you'll meet at at some of these prototype meets, among others, you know, might surprise you. And then what that adds to the overall equation is something that you can't anticipate. You know what I mean? So I encourage people to be open. Include a few more people. Doesn't mean you have to have busloads of NMRA people tromping through your basement if you don't want to do that. But get a few people involved. It might surprise you. Do it. Try it. You might have fun.
Yeah. Well, that sounds great. Mike, would you also plug your website for us too?
My website is www.mrhobby.com. And, my website has, all kinds of cool things on it. We've got some unique products that I basically developed because I wanted them and they weren't out there. So things like, etched brass, two-pipe railings that are used on all kinds of industrial structures. I couldn't believe nobody made that in metal. And I looked high and low. I tried to get some other manufacturers interested in doing it. I offered to provide the artwork, and I eventually said, the heck with this. Yeah, I'm going to do it myself. And that's been actually a very popular item. We've got concrete phone booths that were located all over the Northeast, on Lehigh Valley and DLW and many, many other railroads that are listed on my website that I can't recite off the top of my head. But that's been something that I think has been well received.
Yeah.
We literally went down to Pennsylvania, and Mike Bednar had directed me to one that was on an abandoned line where there were no track and no rails, still standing, and it was basically in some guy's front yard.
Oh, man.
And the guy was outside cutting the grass, and I asked him if he minded if I took some photos and measurements of it, and he said, no, not by all means, knock yourself out. So I think and it was drawn up and designed by Jim Lincoln, and it's 3D printed. And I believe it to be the most accurate model of its type of that particular prototype that is out there. So, those are the kinds of things that you'll see on my website. We've got road access gates, those little triangular welded pipe things that are blocking off the right of ways all over the place that you see everywhere that nobody has on their layout. Well, now there's no excuse. We've got an easy to build kit that enables you to kind of affordably have some for your layout. So that's the kind of stuff you'll see there, in addition to bonding agents, detailed parts that carry the full cannon line, cars and locos, you name it. So I would encourage you to go to mrhobby.com and see if there's anything that floats your boat.
That's great. And you also, and as you mentioned earlier, part of your business is doing decoder installs, correct?
That's true. I've got a burgeoning business doing these installs. I'm direct with Soundtracks and Loke Sound, and heavily involved with Loke Sound in terms of beta testing some new recordings and being able to recommend and test some new features and things like that. So I really think of them as a real up and comer. And so between them and Soundtracks being the industry leader, I think we've got some good offerings in terms of the decoders. But we're doing some very creative things with some surprising types of speakers. And you can take the best decoder in the world and attach it to a crummy speaker, and it's going to sound bad. So
right.
I think you have to be a little bit creative with some of these installs and not just, like, take some off-the-shelf whatever and stick it in there. So we've done a lot with these locos to get them operating properly with the settings that we use and the way we do the sound installs in these locos. And it would surprise you, I think, if you haven't experienced that, if you heard it in person. One of the things that's helped a lot is I bought a nice milling machine, so I can pretty much do anything I want with the metal on the insides of these locomotives. I'm not limited to what I can do with a hacksaw.
Very nice.
So that's kind of what makes the difference between, just a typical sound install or something that is a little bit special, and that's kind of the niche I want to be in.
Well, that sounds great. And, you're funny. You're talking about one of that phone booth. I think I've seen one of those at a mutual friend of the show's, Ralph de Blasi, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And I think he's got one of those phone booths too. It was the octagonal one, is that right? Or eight side? I can't remember.
The very first one we did was an octagon, but the really prototype one is a hexagon.
Gotcha. Okay.
But there's also a pentagon version that's some railroads had, and apparently these were all made by some company whose name escapes me in New Jersey somewhere.
Gotcha.
And they're so rugged that you just can't kill them. They're all over the place even now, even if they're not in use. And they had phone booths, and they also had little watchman shanties, and they had some that were outhouses, and just, you know, all kinds of different ones. So we've chosen to model a couple of them, you know, with and without a smoke jack on the roof. And, you know, if the interest is there, we've got the ability to make other types. What I found was when we first brought them out, boy, did we move a bunch of them to everybody who wanted them. And it slowed down a bit because obviously not every model's that prototype. But
right.
I think, you know, also not everybody knows that they exist even. So I appreciate your helping me get the word out.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And listeners, you can catch Mike Rose on – you guys just recorded a show with Scotty early this week, I think, right?
Yeah, I recorded my segment right – a couple of days after we got back from Collinsville.
Excellent.
And hopefully that'll be out soon.
That's great. And don't forget his website, and also you can see Mike Rose. You're on Facebook, aren't you?
I am. I'm on Facebook. I'm everywhere.
Yep, that's right. Well, Mike, thank you so much for your time tonight and sharing everything that you've learned with us. We really appreciate your time.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I enjoyed it.
Hot start!
Railcasters, for this segment of the show, I've got a guy who's been a friend of the show for a long time, hasn't been on in a while. I think it was somewhere in the late 160s. But we've got Lawrence Eggering back with us. Lawrence, how you doing?
I'm quite well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well. I've got a dram of the Belvaney Doublewood Caribbean finish to accompany me, and so as you can imagine, I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah, it's a good. It's going to be a great podcast.
Exactly. Well, I wanted to have you on because, as you know, and as we talked in the pre-show, the next few shows on the Model Railcast show are going to be operation-centric themed. But you can't operate unless you have one. Your layout is, you know, has some electronics to it, and it's been wired correctly, because you can't operate if your layout has burned to the ground. And I saw this post come on Facebook, I guess this was about 2 weeks ago, where you came across a very, very ugly and potentially frightening situation. Is that correct? Would that be a correct description?
That would be an understatement of what I saw.
Well, we'll talk about what you saw, and then we can talk about some good theory and how to avoid. Now, some of that may naturally work its way into the description, but, you know, good wiring is not just important so that our locomotives run well and so that we don't let out the magic smoke that powers them, but also so that we don't burn our layouts to the ground. And I'm guessing you would agree with that.
It's critically important, yes.
Well,
although the dead rail guys may take some exception to that, but it's still basics of wiring internal to the locomotive that still matter.
Right.
So.
Right. Well, why don't you describe to us the situation that you came across, and I will interject as I can.
Certainly. I was tasked with going to a layout, a Line L layout. It's about 2,000 square feet. So a nice large layout, and a friend of mine was doing some work on putting LED lighting in some buildings to make them a little bit brighter, as they had the MTH or Lionel type little bulbs in them. And he called me because the lights quit working. He had simply added some very low current strip LEDs, and the lights quit working. So he called me down and to help him troubleshoot. He has a little bit of macular degeneration. So, he'll occasionally call me in to help. So I made the trip down to this beautiful layout. I mean, aesthetically walking in, it was, although three rail, and some of the purists out there may think, you know, it's three rail, but the scenery was top notch. The track work was very well done, and the ballasting, everything was great. It was just three rail. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a spaghetti bowl. It was very nicely done. The buildings were done beautifully, et cetera, you know, well modeled and well weathered, you know, so anybody would walk in and say, you know, this is pretty nice. So in the midst of troubleshooting the wiring, I crawled under the layout to trace the wires to find out what was powering the bulbs in them. Now realize there's about between 25 and 30 buildings that have the traditional, you know, 16-volt Lionel bulbs in them that draw about 100 milliamps.
Gotcha.
Okay. 16 of those, that's a pretty good current draw there.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So, you know, as you get further along, you know, that's about an amp and a half, 2 amps minimum. Well, I realized there was much more than that. There was all kinds of Lionel accessories that were hidden around, like searchlight tires.
Okay.
Towers, excuse me, and things like that. So, you know, all in all, almost 75 of these bulbs. Yeah, 7.5 amps. So in the midst of troubleshooting it, I found out the coloring scheme the fellow used, and I was a little shocked at how he did it, and I'll elaborate on that in a few minutes.
Great.
But in tracing it back, I immediately flipped off the power switch on the layout and said, this will not go back on until I have resolved this. And I have never done that. And I've troubleshot live circuits. I mean, it's 12 volts. It's not going to hurt you. You know, it might
sure.
give you a little tingle, you know. But this was an accident waiting for a fire.
Wow.
Instead of using, say, a Lionel transformer like a KW, which is 150 watts, roughly 9 or 10 amps even, this fellow had taken two doorbell transformers that put out about an amp to an amp and a quarter.
Okay.
And he wired them in parallel so he could get 2.5, 3 amps out of them.
I don't think you're supposed to do that.
You can if you're an engineer, but
okay.
there's much better ways of doing
okay.
it. For instance, you buy a 2.5 amp transformer. That would be the smart way to do it.
Right.
These are AC, it's an AC environment.
Right.
Okay. So not a big deal, but he also had available to him two Mike's Trainhouse T4000 transformers. So those are 400 watts, plenty of power, mm-hmm. and he could have used those. Well, as I looked up and I saw these transformers, I started paying a little closer attention to them, and the plywood to which they were mounted underneath the edge of the layout, right where the control transformers are. It's like a big hollow spot with all the electronics in it that you can crawl under and work in. Well, they were mounted vertically up above and right near the front. The two transformers that he was using for that had actually turned the plywood an extreme color brown. Not burnt, but definitely overheated, and they were no longer putting out any current whatsoever. Further examination indicated there was no fuses on either the primary input or on the secondary output. No fuses, no circuit breakers, nothing. So a dead short indicated maximum current flow was going to go through the transformer and possibly start a fire. So that's the beginning.
Okay. I always feel like I need that Law and Order sound effect here. Yes.
So looking around a little bit further to the right, he had three more transformers wired in parallel, that we're running the accessories. Lionel accessories are current hogs. Typically, anybody with a Lionel layout will use a big transformer just to run the accessories. Well, this customer had 18 to 25 accessories. Everything from log loaders, coal loaders, you know, things that go bump in the night, you know, all those things. And he had 3 2.5 amp, and I'm estimating the current on these just from 40 years of electronics experience, sure. Okay? They're about 2 to 2.5 amp transformers wired in parallel. Amazingly, he got the polarity right, which was pretty amazing. So, you know, he at least got that part of it correct without blowing anything up. But again, no fuses on the input, no fuses on the output. So that was disconnected. And then further along, I found two more large transformers that I still don't know what they were powering, but they're not powering it now. Okay.
A little bit of a snipping there to
Yeah, it was no, I took the big pair of cutters and just lopped it. And the customer came in that, I mean, I discovered this about 10 in the morning and we had access to the place. The customer was not there and he's now become a friend. You know, I hadn't met him at that point, but I told him, I said, some people have a habit of bad mouthing people to make themselves look good.
Right.
I said, I don't do that. I said, I'm bad mouthing him because he almost endangered your family.
Right.
And he said, can you show me? And I said, certainly. And I showed him and his jaw dropped. He knows enough about electronics to realize that there was some danger there.
Right.
Well, the other danger was he had of the 7 transformers that were there, he had all of the primaries tied together. And those wires were all twisted together and soldered very nicely to a $1 extension cord from Dollar Tree or wherever. That was plugged into an outlet strip. Yeah.
Diamond that, Jim Spender here.
And the wires were exposed. They were on a European strip. Okay. And it was right under the front edge where if you were going to steady yourself, step, you know, getting down on your knees to crawl into the layout, it's right where your hands would have gone.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, some really bad decisions there. Now, this is the same fellow that did an amazing job on the top of this layout.
Right.
Absolutely amazing. I mean, it beautifully done. But, I mean, as you said at the top, Tim, what good's a layout if it's on fire, you know?
Right.
And I'm going to kind of digress for just a minute, okay?
Please do.
Typically in a modern layout, we're going to use a switching power supply, okay, which is a DC power supply. And most of them will sense the short and just not come on until the short is removed, okay?
Gotcha.
And that's fine. You know, I mean, they're very good at sensing that. The problem even with that is you need to kind of figure out what your maximum current draw for the size of wire you have is and put a fuse or a circuit breaker of that value in. The reason I say that is you could have a low resistance path. In other words, you could have a bulb that just, you know, is shorted, but it's not a complete short. So you have a lot of current draw through that bulb in excess of what it would ordinarily be without it actually opening up, okay? Or being a complete short to shut down the layout. So let's say you have a 15-amp switching power supply, which we're pretty typically buying from our friends across the other pond. And, you know, we pick them up from there because our suppliers get them from there.
Right.
But you've got 15 amps available. You could be drawing 15 amps through a size 20 gauge wire, and that creates an incredible amount of heat in that small wire, and the same thing can happen, flames.
Okay.
So you need to kind of, you know, hook it up as you go along. Go to Harbor Freight, buy a 399 meter, and use the amps setting. If you don't know how to do it, there's 100 websites out there that'll do it. If you're not sure, you can call me. Okay?
Please.
On Skype or, yes. If you're not sure, find someone who is.
Right.
Okay? Find out what the current draw is with all of your buildings lit. Now, typically, if you're using LEDs, it's not going to be that much.
Right.
Okay? My entire layout, using a mixture of bulbs and LEDs, and as the bulbs burn out, I replace them with LEDs, is drawing about an amp and a half. I have a 2.5-amp fuse on it. Okay? So that anything goes wrong, 2.5 amps, I blow the fuse, and I know I've got to look at something.
Okay.
Okay? As the LEDs are replaced, the current's drawing, it drawn is going down. So I've come down from a 3-amp to a, you know, to a 2.5. Eventually, I'll be at probably a 1.5-amp fuse. That way, that power supply is not going to put out 15 amps on a small piece of wire and create a fire.
Okay.
So it's a good safety measure. Fuse holders are available at Radio Shack. They're available online at Amazon. Yeah, I mean, you can find various kinds. There is a ton of YouTube videos on how to hook up fuses and things. Again, if you're not sure, find somebody who is. Worst case, call me. How dangerous is that? So that being said, that's the preliminary safety thing.
And if I could ask you a question real quick on, you mentioned 20-gauge wire, and I think that's basically like a speaker-size wire, isn't it?
Right.
Okay.
That's correct.
So it's like one of the things that the novice just might commonly grab to power his layout. And I guess that was sort of okay when we used like our old DC power packs. That would kind of be all right.
No, typically 20 to 22 gauge is what you're going to use as a riser from the feeder.
Okay.
From your bus up to the track.
Gotcha.
Okay. Okay, as I was saying, Tim, 20-gauge wire is typically what you use from your bus up to the track at the appropriate spacings. Now, for me, each piece of track between joiners gets a riser feeder, okay? And I use 20-gauge for that. And I go down to 14-gauge is typically what I like to use for a bus. Now, I have a couple of spots where the layout was built in the past that have 16 gauge, and I really don't have a problem with that because they're very short runs. Okay. I'm not going to take an hour to go into the theory, which would drive each and every one of us just slightly bonkers, of, you know, the correct current draws for size of wire, et cetera. There's a couple of great NMRA articles out there that are available, you know, to the public even, that will explain why you use the wires the way you do, et cetera.
Gotcha.
So, but yeah, this fellow, moving on to the next thing he did wrong. typically you will take a larger wire, which is as the size of the wire goes down, the number, it's a larger wire. So 14 gauge wire is, you know, basically 4 times smaller than 20, but it's not exactly for those of you who are rivet counters, but it's dramatically bigger, okay? Typically, you would take the output of your transformer, if you're using AC or your power supply, and you would go out to with a 14-gauge bus to a common terminal strip. And then from there, you might take an 18-gauge bus out to the various locations that you're going to have 3 to 4 to 5 buildings off of, okay? And then you could go to a 20-gauge wire up to the buildings. Does that make sense?
That makes sense, yep. I'm with you.
Okay. So that's typically how you would do that, okay? This fellow took 16-gauge wire. I take that back. It was 18-gauge wire. And he went out to the first building, the first set of buildings. There was actually 4 of them on a little plug-in terminal board, which I don't even want to talk about, okay?
Right.
And then he took 2 of the terminals off of that and he used those to run 16-gauge wire down to the next set of 5 buildings, okay? And then he took 16-gauge wire off of that and ran it down to the next set of 5 buildings, and he continued that around in a big circle until he came to the end. Well, the problem with that is the proposal I had in the beginning of going to, you know, with a larger wire and splitting it off is you lose voltage on each foot of the wire just due to the resistance of the wire. Okay.
Right.
In his pattern, it was probably a 100-foot run with this 16-gauge wire. Now that same 16-gauge wire at front end is drawing the entirety of the current for all of those bulbs. So the first set of wires has got all of it, and then it decreases from there. Again, I measured one of the quick ways to do it is, in this case, he was using a connector, a simple plug-on connector onto there, and for the life of me, for this minute, I can't – spade. They're not spade lugs, but they're I've zoned.
Was it the suitcase? So was it the suitcase?
No, 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 he didn't – no. It was – it's the kind where you have a male and a female, and they go together.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, like you're used to seeing on old speakers.
Right, right.
Okay? All right. Add those. And so I went to the first set of connectors and felt of them, and they were quite warm. Okay? So, and that was only after running for about 6 to 8 minutes. Okay? So I made an executive decision to come back with a larger bus wire and connect it back and kind of eliminate the big daisy chain all the way around and at least split it in half. And that made it tolerable. There was not any excess heat at that point. So everything was working pretty well. We were using a Lionel KW transformer, which is 150 watts, 12 volts. If you want to look up Ohm's Law on a website, there's ohmslaw.com. You can find out what the maximum current flow is. Well, I created a short on the transformer and verified that the dissimilar metal type circuit breaker worked, and it did. It went about 8 amps and it died, and I was okay with that. So I also checked the transformer because we had a lot of lights on it, and I wanted to make sure that, you know, we were approaching the end of its current handling capability, and maybe we needed to split it off completely and do two transformers. And while it got warm, it did not get overly hot.
Okay.
Okay? Again, all this is not pertinent if you're using switching power supplies because they're just DC and they're really much better regulated than any kind of a short. But the basic practices are there. Now, what really infuriated me the most about this is not just the sloppy work, it's the endangerment to the people that have come up and visited that layout, because it was, you know, while there is a window and you could have gone out on the roof and you had multiple means of egress, you certainly don't want to get 30 to 45 people in a room that big and have to have somebody climbing out a window because it catches on fire.
Right.
Okay. So, yeah, that will set me off quicker than anything. If you endanger somebody's life for stupidity, it will drive me a little bit bonkers. So. You can leave that or edit it. It's your call.
No, that was good. Nope. I think it needs to be said.
So, at any rate, going through it, the funny thing is, because he's using the Mike's Train House digital command system, DCS, he followed good protocol on the track wiring. I didn't have to change a thing.
Oh, how about that?
This fellow had it in him.
Right.
You know? To do this.
Right.
He also did some silly things like, and I understand in a way it was a good idea. He used some transformers from another company called Z Stuff. But not really transformers, they're relay circuits. Okay. And what he was doing was he was switching the voltage that was coming over to the accessories with the relay. Well, the problem is, the size of the wire on the relay was 28 gauge, which is super small, okay?
That's crazy.
So he would have been better off doing what I did, and that is I just went to the and for UHO guys, you won't understand what an AIU is, but I went to the AIU, and I wired it up with the appropriate size wire, and it's just basically a smart switch.
Okay.
And you can, from the handheld, you can push a button and your device comes on. Okay. And I wired it in with the correct size wire, checked my own work because, hey, I don't trust me either. And, went through and made sure everything was working good and followed those protocols. But, you know, his idea of using the relays was a great idea because then you're switching if he'd had a proper size bus, okay, then he would have been switching the wire from the source rather than having a 10-foot run. And most of these were within 10 feet.
Okay.
Okay. But for the most part, it throws a relay on the device. So it's not a big current draw, but it's just a, there's a better way to do it. So I ran 16 gauge wire to flip the relay. So it was no, really no danger of any problem. And in fact, the terminals on the AIU are made for 16 gauge wire. Anything bigger, it won't work. So.
Okay.
So I redid some of those. And the other thing he did is there was no labeling. You had no clue what color wire was doing what. So my partner is in the middle of doing that now. Al is lying on his back on a creeper with a label machine, labeling everything underneath it. Because this customer wants to be able to say, hey, the log loader isn't working. Where's the log loader plug in?
Right.
You know, so he can crawl underneath and right where the log loader wires come out, he can trace them back if there's a problem. So again, good protocols. While it's, you know, on your layout, you may know where every wire is. I wired portions of my layout 15 years ago, and guess what? I have to remind myself, what did I do here?
Right, right.
And I follow color protocols. So, you know, sometimes you just do things because it's a shortcut, and usually when I find those and think, what the heck was I thinking, I get back in and do the job properly in the end.
Right.
So, you know, as I was talking about track wiring, et cetera, earlier, those same protocols are out there on the NMRA website. There's also countless websites that'll tell you how to wire a model railroad, as well as books and videos on YouTube. I mean, there's countless ways to do it. So if you're not sure, read on them. If it doesn't seem right, it might not be. Look for another opinion. Ask somebody. I have found over 40 years I've been a model railroader that model railroaders will help you faster than anything.
Oh, my goodness, you know? Yes. Absolutely.
And, I mean, look at Craig Biscayer's remodeling of your entire yard, you know?
Yes, I mean, without those ladders, you know.
Of course, if he saw my yard, he'd have a coronary, but that's another story. Mine's built for fun.
That's the know? Well, you don't see, he wouldn't, because yours is built for fun. So
yeah.
The only time he would have the only time he'd have a coronary if somebody's like, well, I've built a very realistic yard, and then they just kind of didn't. So but if somebody's
mine is a realistic yard. The problem is at 50% full, it's only 12 cars. So you know, and I've typically got 15 to 18 in there. So, you know.
Yeah. I think it's a little bit arbitrary anyway, that number.
Yeah, well, it's a small layout. Yeah. So it's single level, you know, 14 by 17. It's not real big.
Right.
So, you know.
You squeeze in what you can.
I have 2 yards in that, so.
See, that's not bad.
No, so, I mean, I can keep you switching all day long.
Yeah.
Mainline runs about 8 minutes, but, you know, hey, what do you do?
No, I mean.
Yeah. Any rate, we digressed, but pay attention, guys. Learn how to solder. Just at the local NMRA meet, we had a soldering clinic, and they taught guys how to tin wires and how to solder properly and use flux and clean up with alcohol. If you're out in the country, there's YouTube videos. I mean, learn to use the internet. Find a book. It'll teach you how to do it. I was very fortunate, and for years in the Navy, I was a NASA certified soldering technician. So I have some good basic techniques down. For those of you who remember, it was called MERPS. But that taught me how to solder, and I was already pretty good, but it taught me a lot that I didn't know. So a couple of guys that were there, you know, at the giving the clinic at the NMRA meet were you know, I pointed out a couple of things to him, and there was another NASA guy there, and we both showed him some little things that make a difference, and such as cleaning the solder joint with alcohol. It's such a good idea. You never leave the flux on there. Even rosin flux will eventually corrode, believe it or not. So you scrub it off, you know, take some time. Pay attention. If you're going to use crimp on connectors, believe it or not, on the main power buses, I take those crimp connectors and I will actually solder the wire to the spade lug on the heavy current draws, because then you have a good connection, not just a mechanical one.
Okay.
So it's a little extra time, and yeah, you need to use a soldering gun, which most guys swear against, but heavy gauge wire like that you do. But in the end, you solder it, you clean it up, you have not only a good mechanical connection, you've got a good electrical connection, and nothing is going to stop it from working. So it's an extra bit.
And these things that these things are not hard to find, the connectors. Yeah.
No, you can go to Ace Hardware, Home Depot, and anything and get spade lugs. Tell them typically the screw-on type terminal strips use a number 8, and then you tell them I need a number 8 spade lug with the gauge of the wire you're going to use. And typically they go in different sizes from 10 to 12, 14 to 16, and then it goes 18 to 22 after that. There's even some neat ones that were done by Atlas years ago that go all the way down to a 24 and 26 gauge wire. And you can crimp those down. And if you feel like you need to solder them, you do, you know. They're not insulated. There's no little rubber insulate on them. But it doesn't matter as long as you're not, you know, unplugging things with the power on. You're never in any danger. And honestly, most model railroad applications, you're not in danger anyway. So,
right. Yeah. And I think, that's probably again, just like you said, but, you know, obviously this person's layout that you were was in danger, but that was because of some other really bad practices in place.
Exactly. It was design flaws,
right?
You know? If you know what, in my layout, you could get away with, you know, doing just about anything because it's small enough. This layout was so big with so many lit devices that it was really a danger, you know? So the bigger your layout gets, the more these protocols need to be followed.
Right.
So it's not an option, guys. I know, you know, the difference is, and somebody won't want to hear this, but you may have to buy 3 fewer boxcars to buy the spade lugs and a good soldering iron.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So go to the next train show and buy some $5 Atherns instead.
Right.
You know, you're gonna, I mean, as we said at the top, how can you run a train when it's on fire?
Right. So. No, that's
crazy. And the dead rail guys, yeah, you have no wiring for track power, but I don't know. Most layouts are boring with dark buildings, you know.
So yeah, these protocols, that's something we forget about.
Yeah. And that's probably where the biggest danger is in the accessory lighting, et cetera.
Right.
Because it'll sneak up on you. I mean, typical LED draws 20 milliamps, all right, which is 0.020. A grain of wheat draws 0.060. So we used to use grain of wheat bulbs and put 4 to 6 of them in a building.
Right.
Okay, you put 4 in, you're at a quarter of an amp on one building.
Right.
Granted, you go with LEDs, you know, you can do 4 or 5 buildings for that. So the LEDs kind of lead into the safety factor because they draw less current, they last longer, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But, you know, they have their own set of problems with using resistors, and that's an entirely different subject. Right. So,
well, that's great. Lawrence, is there one particular site or resource that has meant a lot to you in basically electronic safety and model, or at least good electronic principles when it comes to wiring your model railroads?
Yeah, the NMRA site has probably got the best group of things. You can typically go out on the NMRA site and just do a search for electrical safety protocols and you find something. Now, I'm not doing it at this minute because it would slow the internet connection down and we're on Skype and that's a whole nother story. But yeah, what I'll do, Tim, is I'll do a little digging tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I'll drop you a link to put in the show notes.
That would be perfect.
And I'll send the Ohm's Law link. So you can figure out with how much voltage and current, what the power, you know, what the power rating is. Cause sometimes, manufacturers use power rating on little power brakes. That's
gotcha.
Another thing. Let's jump into that real quick. And,
sure.
And, wall warts. Okay. Guys, they're convenient. You know, we use them for everything. I mean, you know, if you have a Digitrack system, you use them for your UP5s and everything and they're just fine. Realize that voltage on there is kind of a suggestion, that output voltage. If it says 12 volts, it might be 16 because it may be 12 volts loaded down with the appropriate amount of current on it. Okay? So just be careful. If you're going to use a wall wart for your building lighting, you know, if you're going to use LEDs, you might want to increase the size of your current limiting resistor so that they draw a little bit less because the voltage may be higher than your finest calculation. And I have a great website I'll give you for that in the show notes, Jim.
Excellent.
For calculating that resistor, okay?
That's fantastic.
That's a little bonus, you know. So, but yeah, be careful on using wall warts for building lighting, because you get more than one building on a wall wart, you can pretty much overheat them if you're using bulbs. So I recommend, you know, for $20-$25, you can buy a nice DC switching power supply from our friends across the West Coast pond, you know, and you will have plenty of current handling capability, and, you know, and then if you have multiple legs coming off them, put a fuse on each leg, you know, find out what the current draw is, go double your current, the current that it's drawing. If you go double that with a slow blow fuse, you're certainly going to be safe. If you go up 50%, which is my actual recommendation, it's not what the standard is, but it's my standard.
Gotcha.
It just increases that safety factor that little bit, you know.
That's great. That's great. Lawrence, I'd love to get you back on again soon. It's sooner than 2 years, or however long it's been. The one thing I'd love to talk with you about, and I'm thinking maybe even the next 2 weeks, if I can get a hold of you again, I would actually love to talk a little bit about your layout. You know, where sometimes we get into prototype snobbery, if you will, and I know because I've been guilty of it, and sometimes we forget that it's good to have a layout that you can just have fun on. And I've heard lots of fun things about your layout, lots of great puns, and it's time for us to go over that again, if you would be so kind in a couple weeks to do that.
Would you like to give a little teaser?
Yes, let's give a little teaser right now.
The name of the layout is the WDCNP. Okay? We don't care if it's not prototype.
There we go. So We've got to let everybody know, you know, we are not snobs on this show. We love everybody, and just everybody can enjoy the hobby and bring something to it.
Well, but, you know, I do follow certain things. Like I rebuilt an Atlas RS3, and I found a New York Central. I'm a New York Central modeler primarily, okay? Those of you Penzi guys will forgive me, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
But, you know, Penzi did ruin a great railroad company, but you know,
that I was a PRR guy, but I had to admit, nope, New York Central was on its way back and we screwed it up. I'm sorry, but that's just the way it is.
Yeah. But at any rate, I have an RS3. I've done two of them over the winter, one for, my friend Hank. And when we do my layout discussion, I'd love to talk about Hank's layout because I have as many hours on his as I do mine.
Ah.
So, but I built two of these Atlas RS3s with the old Kato drives on them. And I found prototype pictures on an old New York Central archive site. And I actually modeled them pretty close to the prototypes with they were unique paint schemes on the RS3s. So to say I'm not a prototype modeler, I do some prototype modeling. Okay. And, you know, they're not down exact to the lift rings in the right place yet, but you know, at some point I may get there.
Right.
But right now they're very, very close and, very well done. You know, personally, I think, and my friend Hank just raves about his, he shows it to everybody who comes in. And they were both basket cases. They were literally, my friend Dave handed me two boxes of parts and said, "Here, make something out of these."
And nice.
So, yeah, I'd love to come back, Tim. I really would.
Yeah, absolutely. We will do it because after the next couple of shows I release, we're going to need to get into some fun stuff again. And, so yeah, I will give you a call and we'll set up a time and, go over the CMP. Yeah, I like it. Lawrence, thanks so much for your time tonight. We appreciate it.
Oh, I'm happy to be of service. Again, guys, one final word, if I might.
Yes, please
be
do.
Be safe out there. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. You can accidentally leave your layout on all night and have a problem happen in the middle of the night and just not even realize it, right. You know. So it's critically important to do it right the first time.
That's great advice. Great advice. All right, Model Railcasters, that's it for show 210. But I have a lot of stuff recorded. There's going to be a few shows. So I want you guys to be able to sort of do like a Netflix binge here. It's been a while. And so hopefully more shows will be releasing within the next week or two. They should be. I've got all the material recorded. It's just going to be a matter of editing it. But we had lots of great guests come on. We had Seth Newman come on and record a segment. And also was very pleased to finally get a chance to talk with Lionel Strang and Jim Rint and Bruce Wilson of A Modeler's Life. And so we had some great fun times. So that look for that footage and show, probably show 211. Yeah, the next one after this, that'll be in. And also time for some other things I don't want to forget, and that is Bernie Kempinski's new book is coming out, and that's 45 original track plans. He's already showing a sneak peek of the cover on his Facebook page. So once that is available, and I believe it should be available soon, I would really, you know, I want to get a copy, and I know that that's going to be a great book. Bernie's always putting out great stuff, and I just love it when we can support him. Great classic guest and friend of the Model Railcast show. Also, there's a new model railroading podcast out there, Legacies on the Rails, and that's by a friend of ours, John W. Losh II. And I would again highly encourage you to support that podcast. I know I sure will be, and it's just great to have another one out there. All right, that's it for now. The only other announcement I could think of is that, and I was reminded of this when I was dialoguing with Robert Masterson earlier. The pioneers. If there's any pioneers still out there, I believe that you have helped Ryan's family to cover the rest of the bandwidth expenses. So if you're still donating, you can go ahead and stop that because I believe everything has been taken care of and covered. And if you have any questions, I will try and answer what I can. But unfortunately, Ryan was not able to get me all the information about that that he would have liked to. But again, I know he was very thankful for all of your support, and I know that just the way that he sort of did the podcast did incur some expenses. The way I am doing the podcast really does not, you know, again, thanks to the, I'm just following the model that Tom Barblay has put out, and so as a result, any cost I incur is really, it's pretty much just the cost of buying the name every year, and that's easily done because right about the same time it's due is when my tax return comes in. So we appreciate your support. We hope you still continue to listen to the show, those of you who were pioneers. And with that, we will be seeing you guys hopefully later in the week.
And, of course, what we open the show with, we close the show with. The Model Railcast theme. Until next time, guys.
You've been listening to the Model Railcast Show. You can find us at www.modelrailcastshow.com or on Facebook at Friends of MRCS and look for us on iTunes. Don't miss your other great model railroading podcasts out there, The Scotty Mason Show, Model Rail Radio, A Modeler's Life, and the Model Railroad Hobbyist Podcast. And drop us a line if we miss mentioning you. This is Amy Perkins for the Model Railcast Show. Have a great week.